We were recently invited to the Ubuntu Summit, and contrary to popular opinion, that is not a mountain somewhere in the African continent. It is an event that happens at Canonical's headquarters, and there's a limited pool of seats available, I think based on the number of actual chairs they have in the office, because there's not a lot of them. Typically, various podcasters go, and people who write for tech publications go, and it's really a day or so of talks from industry, talks from people inside Canonical, talks from people in the community who have interesting technology to share. And we were there to witness it, and it was a jolly good couple of days. I've not been to one of these before, but I think Martin, you have, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been to all of them since they started in 2022 or 2021, whenever it was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have they always been at the new swanky Canonical office?
This is the second one that's been at the offices in London.
Right. So for those who aren't aware, Canonical has had an office in various places in London, and currently the office that they're in is part of a floor in a building near Tower Bridge, which for me is very convenient because I'm based in King's Cross. It's not very far for me to travel to this. It's very nice inside, very plush. So plush, in fact, that we have to take our rucksacks off.
We're walking around the office.
that would have been nice if they provided slippers. I would have appreciated that. No, you have to take your bag off because I think they've had accidents of people banging into things.
And, oh, my. Okay.
Yeah. And actually, it does look a lot tidier when there aren't loads of laptop bags kicking around. It's quite a nice looking office with bonsai trees and art, and it's just really, really quite posh.
Anyway, enough about an office where we don't get to work. What was the event like?
So the event consisted of a bunch of talks from leading people in industry from significant organizations you've heard of, mixed in with some community kind of projects. Like there was a talk from the leader of the Meshtastic project, which I did not know. I didn't actually know what the schedule was going to be before I arrived. So it was every talk for me was a bit of a surprise because I had no preconception. There was only like one track. It was a small room. Right. The whole thing was live streamed. And as the talk started, they, you know, sat us all down, and then the talk kicked off. There was a little bit of time for Q&A. Their AV team were pretty good at keeping everything on track and making sure, you know, the slides worked and the audio worked and passing around a microphone so that the question could be heard on the stream. It was all a very well-produced thing. I was really impressed. The first talk was actually a kickoff from Mark Shuttleworth, and he was kind of talking about the state of the nation of Canonical and Ubuntu. And I was quite surprised that pretty soon into his talk, there was a screenshot of one of my websites on the slide. The whole slide was snapupdates.popey.com. And that kind of surprised me a little bit because, I wasn't expecting it. And I, you know, wasn't aware. But he showed that as an example of the vibrancy of the Snap ecosystem, because one of the things that it shows is right at the top, number of new snaps today, number of updated snaps today. And that's just a good indicator of how vibrant that ecosystem is.
Yeah, it was also a reminder of just how quickly we've been forgotten, because just before the whole thing started, Mark Shuttleworth walked up to me and said, oh, I've just updated a slide with your Snap Updates thing in it. And I said, that's not me, that's him, and pointed at you. And yes. I think he had a little reminisce of, oh, yeah, these two, I remember them.
Tweedledum and Tweedledee, they're back again. Yes. Anyway, I appreciated it, and I got a call out in the audience. He said, yeah, this is Popey's thing. And I later found out that actually this feature, just that little thing that says how many snaps are new and updated in the store, is something they're going to put on the proper Snap Store. And that is quite a bit of validation for me that I've knocked together this little website to highlight how I think the Snap Store could look to show there are things coming all the time. And they clearly agree, and there's an internal task to track this. And that kind of made me feel pretty good, actually. Another thing that they talked about was, well, as a product launch, actually, was something called Canonical Workshop, which, if you've listened to a previous episode, I talked about a project called Lincubate, where I use LexD containers to containerize AI agents and other tools. It's basically that.
Yeah.
But done a lot better and cleaner than I could have done it, unsurprisingly. Now, you know, they've got a team of people working on this kind of stuff, and it looks really good. And you can spin up a container with all the right tools that you want and have them nicely isolated. Go back and listen to Lincubate. It's that, but professional and supported by Canonical.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I was looking at this and like how it would work, like linking what's in this container in with your IDE for where you're actually developing your code. And it turns out that the way that you do that is you essentially remote into a copy of your IDE that's also in the container and can therefore access all the code and interact with all the other stuff inside. Which
is exactly what I did in Lincubate. Yeah. Precisely the same thing. So yeah, it's kind of weird that we'd both do the same thing.
Yeah,
and that Ubuntu workshop was one of several presentations about sort of the Ubuntu ecosystem of getting things done. And I think that plus there was a talk about all of the automated ways in which you can provision and configure Ubuntu now. So there was a whole bunch of tooling around this, and I'm very interested in what they presented with the automated install stuff, because I knew half of it was there, the Cloud Init stuff, but I didn't know how the new automated installer process worked. So I'm going to be working on something that takes advantage of both of those things for a little update on a project you've heard about here, and I'll be using these new things I learned about at the summit to polish it a bit.
Conversely, I will almost certainly be archiving the Lincubate project and just signposting workshop. It's absolutely pointless me maintaining that.
I think that's wise.
Workshop just does it all. I mentioned Meshtastic. That talk was interesting and kind of fired me up a little bit more to get back into mesh networking. And there were plenty of other talks that were interesting, but interesting in a different way. There were people from industry, like there was people from NVIDIA, someone from AMD, talking about stuff. There was a guy talking about a community project, Bootsy. There was like a lot of tech stuff that was interesting that kept my attention for the whole time we were there. And also, Martin, you gave a lightning talk, didn't you?
I did. I gave a lightning talk about Jive Talking. Yes. I managed to get through it in 5 minutes and 6 seconds after some rehearsals.
And I gave one about doing that silly contest, vibe coding contest I did earlier in the year. It's actually last year now. And I did not stick to 5 minutes. I went to about 7 minutes, unfortunately, because I did not practice it because I wrote it in lunchtime on that day. Yeah, that went down fairly well. And all the talks are actually published on the Canonical YouTube channel now. Mm-hmm. So we'll put a link to their channel because, yeah, they'll need the attention from our audience, obviously.
And did you use MojiNav to find your way to the event?
No, because I knew exactly where it was. it's just right next to Tower Bridge, and I know where that is. So, no, I did not on this occasion use MojiNav. But the other part of it was quite interesting, the what they call the hallway track, where you're just chatting to people over coffee. And there were some super interesting people there doing cool stuff. And like I say, go and watch the videos because it's pretty cool. But also, some of our friends were there. We met up with Ken on the desktop team, Ken Van Dyne, and also Mario Limoncello from the Ubuntu Myth TV remix he worked on a long time ago. Yep. Mythbuntu now works at AMD on a thing called Lemonade. Ken works on that as well. And we also bumped into Graham and Will. And Phelim and Maru and Aaron went out for drinks and beers and Mexican food. It was lovely. It was a really, really nice time. Lots of tech stuff, lots of interesting talks, and some socials as well. So yeah, I will definitely go to this if I'm invited another time.
Well, speaking of Jive Talking has evolved, and a lot of that work has actually happened since we were at the Ubuntu Summit, because also in attendance at the Ubuntu Summit was Marius Quebec, who is a podcaster and podcast producer and also writes for Linux Magazine, among other things. And he is customer zero. Maybe he's customer one.
I think we're zeros.
Yeah, we're customer zero. So he's customer one for Jive Talking. And we met up at OgCamp earlier in the year, and I went through a short list of bugs that he was reporting in Jive Talking. And we had a bit of a chat. And so Jive Talking has taken on a new direction, and I thought I'd give a little update. And for anyone that doesn't know what this is about, Jive Talking is the software that I wrote in order to produce the audio for this podcast. So it takes our raw audio recordings and turns them into audio that's suitable for publishing as a podcast, with all of the leveling and EQ stuff being done for us automatically. Because at that time, I said neither of us were audio engineers, but I think I'm dangerously close to becoming a self-taught audio engineer at this point. So the first thing I did was updated FFmpeg Statigo, which is this static build of FFmpeg that is like the engine of FFmpeg with Go bindings, because Jive Talking's written in Go. So I've updated it to the latest version of FFmpeg, which bought us a extra feature in one of the filters that I needed, and I'll get to that in a moment. And whilst I was at it, I updated the API coverage. So there's now 90% of the API coverage is available through FFmpeg Statigo. And I've got to the point where I'm just going to wait and see what I need now, rather than trying to get to 100%, because it's all the really difficult stuff. But to close the gap from 85 to 90%, I basically pointed a local LLM at all of the bindings that had been dynamically created by this Clang parser and said, do that, but for all of these ones that aren't already available. And it did. It built and tested another 4 or 5% of the APIs that I needed to do the next round of development. Whilst I was working on FFmpeg Statigo, it's got a new Go package inside it, which is just called AV. And the reason for this is the way that you use FFmpeg Statigo, or the way I've been using it, is like you're a C programmer, managing memory and pointers and casting types and all sorts of stuff like that. So what AV is it wraps the large API surfaces, and it's a memory safe way with all of automatically freeing in the right order behind itself. So this is sort of a friendly interface, or Go idiomatic interface, to FFmpeg without having to do all of the gnarly memory handling stuff. Now, at the top of Mario's shopping list was, can I make it faster? When I originally made it, it processed audio sequentially. So if we fed in our three audio files, it would do Mark, and it would do me, and then it would do Popey, and that would take, I don't know, 10 or 12 minutes. So refactored the internals of Jive Talking. So it can take all three, and it runs all three processes in parallel. So now all three run alongside one another, and it takes the length of one podcast to process all three of us.
So when we've been using it for our show, I've never sat there thinking, oh, this takes too long to do all of this stuff, which would otherwise take us quite a long amount of time. I assume that Marius has use cases where it would take a lot longer to process than ours would.
Yeah, he has lots of customers. So the time he has to wait for this to happen is like an impact for him. And I think this week he's doing some conference in Germany, and he said to me that he's got like 50 audio files he needs to process. So the parallel processing automatically detects the number of CPUs you've got in your machine, and it scales to number of CPUs wide processing. And it scales linearly because of Go routines. So on my machine, it will run 32 encodes side by side. So, and it uses like 98% of the CPU. It's great. So that was one way to make it faster. And then what I did was, I'd been collecting metrics, but not in a very clever way. It was in a bit of a weird like text file that was sort of presented in a fancy way. So I've changed that to producing structured markdown reports for humans. And then internally, it's got a data structure that's basically a big JSON object, and it can dump out those JSON objects at the end. And the reason I've done this is that I've found that one of the ways to improve the audio quality of Jive Talking is to have it produce all of these audio metrics and feed those into a local LLM and say, analyze all of these numbers, because all of these spectral metrics mean, you know, important things in terms of how the audio quality is and what sort of audio it can hear. And so I've now got this loop where I can process, I think we've got like 60 tracks in my test audio, which is a whole bunch of hours and some that Marius has provided and some that have come from some other podcast producers. And the ones I've collected from the other podcasts are the ones where things went wrong, where we want like Jive Talking to try and do the best it can to recover the audio. So maybe it's clipping or it's under-recorded or there's a lot of background noise. Now, we have some of those of our own.
Oh, no, surely not. No, that sort of thing never happens to us.
It does when we're recording in unfamiliar environments, you know. So I've been running round this loop of things and having the LLM analyze the audio before and after and then tweaking parameter settings until it says this is the best quality or this is audibly identical, but it processes faster. You know, so it's right. Been looking at the FFmpeg source code and figuring out how to dial things in. So that has been a real time saver now because I can really sort of turn around one, bug solving is easier because I can run the audio. It produces a load of data. I can feed it into the LLM and it can immediately tell me what the issues are. And for fun, it's got quite a nice TUI, text-based UI, or it had one, but it's got a nicer one now. So earlier in the year, Charm Bracelet, who make a whole bunch of sort of text UI widgets and easing functions and things, they released their version 2 of all of their tooling. So I've uplifted all of the internals to use the new versions of Bubble Tea and Bubbles and what have you.
When we were at the Ubuntu Summit, you were chatting to someone from Arm who's working on some rather cool performance tooling. And after he heard about Jive Talking, I think he had a conversation with you about running it in automation, like to... or on a remote machine, a headless machine, and had some trouble. Have you resolved that problem? And what was that about?
Yeah, so it's because of the way Bubble Tea works. It doesn't expose a proper TTY, so you need to create a pseudo TTY. And there's actually facilities in Bubble Tea to do that. So now when Jive Talking starts, it looks to see if there's a pseudo TTY underneath it, and if that's the case, that's fine. And if not, it creates one internally and exposes that. So that can then be hooked into by these tools to do profiling and what have you, which is what this guy from Arm was doing. They were demonstrating their new profiler for Arm CPUs and their accelerated extensions. And he wanted to use Jive Talking in his presentation the following day.
Is that because it does a lot of stuff with the CPU?
Yes, because it does all the things with the CPU and I've got all of the acceleration options turned on. Now, what he did do is he processed all of his audio with it, which was kind of good.
Yeah, he did say that one of his examples was to process audio because, like, yeah, you can point FFmpeg at something and get it to do a lot and then you can analyze the performance of that. And I think he said he was going to use Jive Talking anyway just to improve the audio.
Right.
Well, that's good news anyway.
Yeah, we're picking up users all over the place. There's quite a body of people using it now. And I suppose the biggest departure is when I started this project, I was modeling the audio processing on vintage audio hardware, mostly because I thought that was within the grasp of my understanding of, like, I can understand how, like, a basic compressor works, and therefore I should be able to understand how to re-implement that with the FFmpeg filters. Well, as of the version that we'll be releasing soon, and by the time you hear this podcast, it will be out, the whole audio processing chain is now state-of-the-art DSP processing. And all of that emulation of analog stuff, I've learned important lessons from doing that, like how to treat audio lightly, least treatment and transparently. But none of that sort of faithful reproduction of those audio circuits exists anymore. So it's very much a DSP-based system now internally. And one of the reasons for doing that is that Marius has customers that record podcasts in different ways. So some people record podcasts like we do. You record the audio locally, and you know the old tricks of recording 15 seconds of silence, so you have a noise bed to use in your audio editor. And we had modelled that workflow in Jive Talking. There was an expectation you record a bit of silence to get the room tone, and then you remove it with the editing tools after the fact. But the online platforms all have voice-activated recording, so they gate to digital zero between phrases, so there is no room tone to work from, or at least there wasn't in the way that I'd implemented it. So I did some research and I found out there's some well-published papers about voice activity detection, and these are radio and cell phone standards, and even organizations like Orphonic have like contributed to this study. And that's how Jive Talking now works. So what it actually does now is it looks for the areas of speech and it builds a spectrogram of the speech areas, which we can identify with these spectral metrics that we collect. And then it masks those regions of speaking out. And what you're left with is the regions of noise. And then it looks for the longest run of noise that's left over. And then it builds a 15 frequency audio profile of that longest run of noise. And then it uses wavelets to then remove that noise profile from the frequencies throughout. So that can actually remove noise from like underneath the, riding underneath the speech. So the whole leveling and noise removal now is much more sophisticated. And it also means that Jive Talking is what I set out to do. It is truly no configuration, because you don't need to guide it at all in order to tell it where the silence was, because it will just find it.
So that's what you've done, and that'll be in the release that people will have available. What's next?
So one of the talks we saw at the Ubuntu Summit was a talk about DuckDB, which I hadn't heard. Well, I'd heard of, but I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know why I should care about it over SQLite.
we were target audience for that talk. We really were.
And now I've learned, and it is like SQLite, but it's definitely geared towards sort of analytics and time series analysis. So that data object that I'm recording in memory at the moment and then dumping out as a JSON file, I'm thinking I might hook that up to DuckDB and store that as a database entry, because then I can go back and query it and do much more interesting things with it. And I can also hurl the spectrogram images into it as well and have, you know, a little database that sits alongside the audio.
Would you consider having a thing where people could send you like the DuckDB, because it's markdown files basically, isn't it? Or like CSV files or something like really easily that a human could look at it and go, okay, there's nothing personally identifiable in there. Yeah, I'll send it to Martin. That maybe would feed, you know, further developments of the tool.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm taking all the requests I've had. We fixed all of the bugs. We've implemented all of the features. It's just been steady improvement all the way. And it's a fun project. And I'm thinking, I've got a nice little engine here. Perhaps I'll turn this into a virtual microphone tool. So you can talk into your microphone or your laptop, and it will do the same thing, but expose a virtual mic that it sounds a bit better.
I've been continuing to knock games off my Steam wishlist backlog, and this time I've been playing The Last of Us Part 1.
Is this the mushrooms game?
The mushrooms game. Yeah. The one where you're the little plumber. So this is a game I've had on my list for a while. So it was originally released as a PlayStation exclusive, but then they remastered it and released a PC version of the remaster. And at that point, I put it on my wish list and kind of left it there, because it's quite a sort of story-heavy game, very narrative focused, and at that point I didn't have the headspace for that because I had some other quite heavy games going on. But in the meantime, there's already a sequel out. They've released a TV series of it, which I've then been avoiding because I wanted to have played the game before I saw the TV version of it. But I finally now got around to playing it.
So what era PlayStation game is it, and when was the PC remaster released?
It was either, the original version was either, I think it might be PS3, I think, and then the remaster is a couple of years old now, possibly.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I think so. Or maybe it's even older than that now, because there was also a remaster of the second part, I think. It's a bit complicated. But yeah, the remaster also has... So the original was just called The Last of Us, and then they released The Last of Us Part 2. So the remaster is called The Last of Us Part 1, which also has some extra chapters in it and yeah, boosted graphics and stuff like that. So obviously I've been playing this on the Steam Deck, and I think the graphics is something that's really important to point out, because some of the other games I've been talking about recently, I've been sort of saying, oh, well, you know, some parts of it don't look that good, but maybe that's because on the Steam Deck it's got lower settings, and if I was playing on something more powerful, it might look a bit better. None of that with this. It looks absolutely fantastic everywhere. Like, the environments are super rich, the colours are amazing, the characters are detailed, like, performance is brilliant. It is one of the best looking games I've played on the Steam Deck, for sure. It's really good.
I just popped open the Steam page, as is my wont, and it says Last of Us Part 1 was released 3 years ago,
right,
March 2023. And I have seen the TV show, no spoilers, but I have seen the TV show. And just scrolling through the screenshots on the Steam page, I can now reminisce about watching the TV show. And now, actually, I want to play this game now, because it's a great TV show. I really love the TV show. And so now I would quite like this.
I've read reviews of the game from people who did it both ways round, and they say that doing one first doesn't spoil the other, whichever way around you do it. But I mean, basically, as an overview, Alan referred to it as the mushroom game. Essentially, it's like a survival horror game in a future where the world's been taken over by a cordyceps fungus, which in the real world is a fungus that infects ants and basically turns them into zombies and makes them march up a tree and die there. And then the mushroom grows out and puts spores everywhere. But it's a version of that that then affects humans and essentially turns them into zombies. So you're a couple of characters living in this world and trying to survive. So there's sort of echoes of things like Resident Evil, but it's not, it's survival horror, but it's not too heavy on the horror. There's a lot of tension. Like, I found that in a lot of the sections, it really got your heart pumping, but they don't lean into things like jump scares, which I really hate in games. Mm-hmm. I find they're a bit tedious and detract from the fun. So I'm really glad they don't do that. But yeah, there's a lot of sort of stealth mechanics. It's quite interesting because you're usually either opposed by humans or the mushroom zombies. The interesting thing there being that the zombies can't see, they can only hear, but they can hear a lot better than the people can hear.
Huh.
So you've got two different modes of stealth, one where you're trying to avoid being seen and one where you're trying to avoid being heard. And in general, I found like you get into it a bit and you get into these first sort of couple of stealth sections. And then I started thinking, okay, it's fun, but if the whole game is going to be, oh, here's another bit where you've got to sneak through some zombies and get to the other side of the room, and then you're in the next room and you've got to do the same thing with more zombies, that's going to get pretty tedious for the whole like run of a game. But actually, they do a really good job of each chapter sort of changing it up. So there's some new gameplay elements. It kind of reminded me a bit of playing Half-Life 2, where the whole thing is, you know, a sort of first-person shooter slash physics puzzler. But each chapter of that, there's some kind of different mode of gameplay that's introduced and keeps the whole thing really interesting going throughout.
Do you play one of the characters? Because you said there's two main characters.
Yeah.
Do you play one of them or both of them? How does that work?
So most of the time...
Is it like head over heels where you can switch between them and sit on the other person's shoulders or something?
No, it's not quite like that. You're mostly playing as one of the characters with the other one following you and helping you out. But then occasionally there's like a chapter where you switch to the other one for a bit to do something where the other one's not available or whatever. So you get to experience both of them, and they've got sort of different, slightly different abilities. Like one of them smaller than the other one and one of them stronger than the other one. It's kind of interesting because the main character, Joel, I actually found I didn't like him very much. It's kind of interesting to have to play through as a character who you don't really empathize get on with.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Do you think that's deliberate character writing?
Yeah, kind of. I think, especially the way the game ends, I think, you know, they knew who they were writing. I don't think it's meant to make you dislike him, but it's he's definitely written that way because that's who he is, kind of thing.
I notice what you're describing actually does feel very similar to my experience of watching the TV show. Was there are scary bits, yeah. And like, you know, there's a lot of tension in it, but also there are some real empathetic moments and story,
like, yeah,
really innovative non-horror,
yeah,
story narratives in some of the episodes. It's really, really, really well done.
Yeah. So like a lot of the way that it's broken up is, yeah, you'll go through one of the chapters where there's like, yeah, sort of some of the stealth bits and some of the scary bits, but then the next chapter you'll be sort of collecting things to craft with, because you can craft like tools and weapons and upgrades and stuff like that. But while you're doing that, you'll be going around some houses, and in the houses there'll be things from the people who've left there, and that gives you some backstory about what happened to the people. And there's some people like you're like following their journey through the area that you're in, and so yeah, it's like a bit of a chill bit where you know nothing's going to be there, and you can just explore and take your time and learn about like the backstory rather than it being just all told to you through dialogue.
How long have you been playing this? When did this come off your wish list and into your grubby hands?
So I actually finished it now. So I think it was probably about somewhere around 20 hours it took me to play through, which is fairly typical, I think, of this sort of game. I mean, you can do then play through on harder difficulty as well if you want to, but I chose to move on at that point. At some point I will go and play part two, but I can't remember what I'm playing. Oh, I'm still playing Celasta, so I can't get onto that just yet.
I was going to ask you, like, you've got this backlog of games, so these are games that you have purchased that you haven't played or are in your wish list that you intend to play. Do you have like a one in, one out policy, or have you got lots of games in your library that you've not played yet?
Yes and yes. No, so I did have quite a strict, after my daughter was born, I did actually develop quite a strict one in, one out policy, because I thought, you know, I've got to just focus on one game. I can't have more than one game on the go. So I would get a game and I would play it all the way through and complete it before I got onto a next game. But now I'm a bit more lax with myself, where if I feel like I've got enough enjoyment out of a game, I'll park it and play something else for a bit. I still don't generally have two where I'm like actively jumping between them, but I'll have several like on the back burner that I can go back to. Because what I tend to find is if I've played a game for a bit and then like leave it for a while, suddenly I'll have a hankering and think, oh, I could do with playing a bit of that. And oh, look, I've still got the last 30% of that game to do, so I can go back and do that now. And that's quite nice to have in the back pocket.
And do you have a always installed game, something that you always go back to and just have a little play from time to time?
I do have Vampire Survivors, which I'll occasionally just pick up and just have a quick run of if I've got, you know, not got a lot of time. But I just fancy something. Vampire Survivors is quite a good one for that.
When you say not got a lot of time, I've had a good couple of hours disappear playing that game before now, or an entire flight disappear playing that game.
You can, but each game only lasts like, what is it, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and then it finishes whether you've died or not at that point. So you've got a good like little time window. You can, of course, you can play it more times if you want to. Just one more.
So I notice I'm just about to add this game to my wish list. It's 50 quid. It's not cheap.
I got it on sale.
Ah, there we go.
Yes. Summer sales are coming soon.
Right. Well, I'm definitely going to add it to my wish list. I have a feeling, Mark, maybe this is a feature for our website. We should put our Steam wish lists on the website so people can see the games that we're waiting for, and maybe if we get if people have opinions on things, they can like send us emails or ping us in the Telegram channel or get in contact some other way and let us know their unvarnished opinions of the games that are in our wish lists. Maybe
that sounds good. I might look at doing that.